4. Agriculture. Civilization was impossible in the hunting stage. It called for a permanent habitat, a settled way of life. It came with the home and the school, and these could not be till the products of the field replaced the animals of the forest or the herd as the food of man. The hunter found his quarry with increasing difficulty, while the woman whom he left at home tended an ever more fruitful soil. This patient husbandry by the wife threatened to make her independent of the male, and for his own lordship's sake he forced himself at last to the prose of tillage. No doubt it took centuries to make this greatest of all transitions in human history, but when at last it was made, civilization began. Meredith said that woman will be the last creature to be civilized by man. He was wrong, as it is possible to be in the limits of one sentence. For civilization came through two things chiefly: the home, which developed those social dispositions that form the psychological cement of society, and agriculture, which took man from his wandering life as hunter, herder, and killer, and settled him long enough in one place to let him build homes, schools, churches, colleges, universities, civilization. But it was woman who gave man agriculture and the home. She domesticated man as she domesticated the sheep and the pig. Man is woman's last domestic animal, and perhaps he is the last creature that will be civilized by woman. The task is just begun. One look at our menus reveals us as still in the hunting stage. 5. Social organization. Here are two men disputing. One knocks the other down, kills him, and then concludes that he who was alive must have been right, and that he who was dead must have been wrong. A mode of demonstration still accepted in international disputes. Here are two other men disputing. One says to the other, "Let us not fight. We may both be killed. Let us take our difference to some elder of the tribe and submit to his decision." It was a crucial moment in human history. For if the answer was no, barbarism continued. If it was yes, civilization planted another root in the memory of man: the replacement of chaos with order, of brutality with judgment, of violence with law. Here, too, it is a gift unfelt, because we are born within the charmed circle of its protection, and never know its value till we wander into the disordered or solitary regions of the earth. God knows that our congresses and our parliaments are dubious inventions, the distilled mediocrity of the land, but despite them, we manage to enjoy a security of life and property which we shall appreciate more warmly when civil war or revolution reduces us to primitive conditions. Compare the safety of travel today with the robber-infested highways of medieval Europe. Never before in history was there such order and liberty as exist in England today, and may someday exist in America, when a way is found of opening municipal office to capable and honorable men. However, we must not excite ourselves too much about political corruption or democratic mismanagement. Politics is not life, but only a graft upon life. Under its vulgar melodrama, the traditional order of society quietly persists. In the family, in the school, in the thousand devious influences that change our native lawlessness into some measure of cooperation and goodwill. Without consciousness of it, we partake in a luxurious patrimony of social order built up for us by 100 generations of trial and error, accumulated knowledge, and transmitted wealth. 6. Morality. Here we touch the very heart of our problem. Are men morally better than they were? So far as intelligence is an element in morals, we have improved. The average of intelligence is higher, and there's been a great increase in the number of what we may vaguely call developed minds. So far as character is concerned, we have probably retrogressed. Subtlety of thought has grown at the expense of stability of soul. In the presence of our fathers, we intellectuals feel uncomfortably that, though we surpass them in the number of ideas that we have crowded into our heads, and though we have liberated ourselves from delightful superstitions which still bring them aid and comfort, we are inferior to them in uncomplaining courage, fidelity to our tasks and purposes, and simple strength of personality. But if morality implies the virtues exalted in the code of Christ, we have made some halting progress despite our mines and slums, our democratic corruption, and our urban addiction to lechery. We are a slightly gentler species than we were, capable of greater kindness and of generosity even to alien or recently hostile peoples whom we have never seen. In one year, 1928, the contributions of our country to private charity and philanthropy exceeded $2 billion, which was then one half of all the money circulating in America. We still kill murderers if, as occasionally happens, we catch them and convict them. But we are a little uneasy about this ancient retributive justice of a life for a life, and the number of crimes for which we mete out the ultimate punishment has rapidly decreased. 200 years ago, in Merry England, men might be hanged by justification of the law for stealing a shilling. and people are still severely punished if they do not steal a great deal. Not that many hundred years ago, miners were hereditary serfs in Scotland. Criminals were legally and publicly tortured to death in France. Debtors were imprisoned for life in England, and respectable people raided the African coast for slaves. Less than 100 years ago, our jails were dens of filth and horror, colleges for the graduation of minor criminals into major criminals. Now our prisons are vacation resorts for tired murderers. We still exploit the lower strata of our working classes, but we soothe our consciences with welfare work. Eugenics struggles to balance, with artificial selection, the interference of human kindliness and benevolence with that merciless elimination of the weak and the infirm, which was once the mainspring of natural selection. We think there is more violence in the world than before, but in truth there are only more newspapers. Vast and powerful organizations scour the planet for crimes and scandals that will console their readers for stenography and monogamy. And all the villainy and politics of five continents are gathered upon one page for the encouragement of our breakfasts. We conclude that half the world is killing the other half, and that a large proportion of the remainder are committing suicide. But in the streets, in our homes, in public assemblies, in 1,000 vehicles of transportation, we are astonished to find no murderers and no suicides, but rather a blunt democratic courtesy, and an unpretentious chivalry, 100 times more real than when men mouthed chivalric phrases, enslaved their women, and ensured the fidelity of their wives with irons, while they fought for Christ in the Holy Land. Our prevailing mode of marriage, chaotic and deliquescent as it is, represents a pleasant refinement on marriage by capture or purchase, and le droit des seigneurs. There is less brutality between men and women, between parents and children, between teachers and pupils, than in any recorded generation of the past. The emancipation of woman and her ascendancy over man indicate an unprecedented gentility in the once murderous male. Love, which was unknown to primitive men, or was only a hunger of the flesh, has flowered into a magnificent garden of song and sentiment, in which the passion of a man for a maid, though vigorously rooted in physical need, rises like incense into the realm of living poetry. And youth, whose sins so disturb its tired elders, atones for its little vices with such intellectual eagerness and moral courage as may be invaluable when education resolves at last to come out into the open and cleanse our public life. 7. Tools. In the face of the Romantics, the machine wreckers of the intelligentsia, the pleaders for a return to the primitive, dirt, chores, snakes, cobwebs, bugs, we sing the song of the tools, the engines, the machines that have enslaved and are liberating man. We need not be ashamed of our prosperity. It is good that comforts and opportunities once confined to barons and earls have been made by enterprise the prerogatives of all. It was necessary to spread leisure, even though at first misused, before a wide culture could come. These multiplying inventions are the new organs with which we control our environment. We do not need to grow them on our bodies as animals must. We make them and use them and lay them aside till we need them again. We grow gigantic arms that build in a month the pyramids that once consumed 1 million men. We make for ourselves great eyes that search out the invisible stars of the sky, and little eyes that peer into the invisible cells of life. We speak, if we wish, with quiet voices that reach across continents and seas. We move over the land and the air with the freedom of timeless gods. Granted that mere speed is worthless, it is a symbol of human courage and persistent will that the airplane has its highest meaning for us. Long chained, like Prometheus to the earth, we have freed ourselves at last, and now we may look the eagle in the face. No, these tools will not conquer us. Our present defeat by the machinery around us is a transient thing, a halt in our visible progress to a slaveless world. The menial labor that degraded both master and man is lifted from human shoulders and harnessed to the tireless muscles of iron and steel. Soon, every waterfall and every wind will pour its beneficent energy into factories and homes, and man will be freed for the tasks of the mind. It is not revolution, but invention that will liberate the slave. 8. Science. In a large degree, Buckle was right. We progress only in knowledge, and these other gifts are rooted in the slow enlightenment of the mind. Here, in the untitled nobility of research and the silent battles of the laboratory, is a story fit to balance the chicanery of politics and the futile barbarism of war. Here man is at his best, and through darkness and persecution mounts steadily toward the light. Behold him standing on a little planet, measuring, weighing, analyzing constellations that he cannot see, predicting the vicissitudes of earth and sun and moon, and witnessing the birth and death of worlds. Or here is a seemingly unpractical mathematician tracking new formulas through laborious labyrinths, clearing the way for an endless chain of inventions that will multiply the power of his race. Here is a bridge, 100,000 tons of iron suspended from four ropes of steel, flung bravely from shore to shore, and bearing the passage of countless men. This is poetry as eloquent as Shakespeare ever wrote. Or consider this city-like building that mounts boldly into the sky, guarded against every strain by the courage of our calculations, and shining like diamond-studded granite in the night. Here in physics are new dimensions, new elements, new atoms, and new powers. Here in the rocks is the autobiography of life. Here in the laboratories, biology prepares to transform the organic world as physics transform matter. Everywhere you come upon them studying these unpretentious, unrewarded men, you hardly understand where the devotion finds its source and nourishment. They will die before the trees they plant will bear fruit for mankind, but they go on. Yes, it is true that this victory of man over matter has not yet been matched with any kindred victory of man over himself. The argument for progress falters here again. Psychology has hardly begun to comprehend, much less to control, human conduct and desire. It is mingled with mysticism and metaphysics, with psychoanalysis, behaviorism, glandular mythology, and other diseases of adolescence. Careful and modified statements are made only by psychologists of whom no one ever hears. In our country, the democratic passion for extreme statements turns every science into a fad. But psychology will outlive these ills and storms. It will be matured, like older sciences, by the responsibilities which it undertakes. If another Bacon should come to map out its territory, clarify the proper methods and objectives of its attack, and point out the fruits and powers to be won, which of us, knowing the surprises of history and the pertinacity of men, would dare set limits to the achievements that may come from our growing knowledge of the mind? Already in our day, man is turning round from his remade environment and beginning to remake himself. 9. Education. More and more completely, we pass on to the next generation the gathered experience of the past. It is almost a contemporary innovation, this tremendous expenditure of wealth and labor in the equipment of schools and the provision of instruction for all. Perhaps it is the most significant feature of our time. Once colleges were luxuries, designed for the male half of the leisure class. Today universities are so numerous that he who runs may become a PhD. We have not excelled the selected geniuses of antiquity, but we have raised the level and average of human knowledge far beyond any age in history. Think now not of Plato and Aristotle, but of the stupid, bigoted, and brutal Athenian assembly, of the unfranchised mob and its Orphic rites, of the secluded and enslaved women who could acquire education only by becoming courtesans. None but a child would complain that the world has not yet been totally remade by these spreading schools, these teeming bisexual universities. In the perspective of history, the great experiment of education has just begun. It has not had time to prove itself. It cannot, in a generation, undo the ignorance and superstition of 10,000 years. Indeed, there is no telling but the high rate of ignorance and the determination of dogma by plebiscite may triumph over education in the end. This step in progress is not one of which we may yet say that it is a permanent achievement of mankind, but already beneficent results appear. Why is it that tolerance and freedom of the mind flourish more easily in the northern states than in the south, if not because the south has not yet won wealth enough to build sufficient schools? Who knows how much of our preference for mediocrity in office and narrowness in leadership is the result of a generation recruited from regions too oppressed with economic need and political exploitation to spare time for the plowing and sowing of the mind? What will the full fruitage of education be when every one of us is schooled till 20 and finds equal access to the intellectual treasures of the race? Consider again the instinct of parental love, the profound impulse of every normal parent to raise his children beyond himself. Here is the biological leverage of human progress, a force more to be trusted than any legislation or any moral exhortation, because it is rooted in the very nature of man. Adolescence lengthens, we begin more helplessly, and we grow more completely toward that higher man who struggles to be born out of our darkened souls. We are the raw material of civilization. We dislike education because it was not presented to us in our youth for what it is. Consider it not as the painful accumulation of facts and dates, but as an ennobling intimacy with great men. Consider it not as the preparation of the individual to make a living, but as the development of every potential capacity in him for the comprehension, control, and appreciation of his world. Above all, consider it in its fullest definition as the technique of transmitting as completely as possible to as many as possible That technological, intellectual, moral, and artistic heritage through which the race forms the growing individual and makes him human. Education is the reason why we behave like human beings. We are hardly born human. We are born ridiculous and malodorous animals. We become human. We have humanity thrust upon us through the 100 channels whereby the past pours down into the present that mental and cultural inheritance, whose preservation, accumulation, and transmission place mankind today, with all its defectives and illiterates, on a higher plane than any generation has ever reached before. 10. Writing and print. Again, our imagination is too weak-winged to lift us to a full perspective. We cannot vision or recall the long ages of ignorance, impotence, and fear that preceded the coming of letters. Through those unrecorded centuries, men could transmit their hard-won lore only by word of mouth from parent to child. If one generation forgot or misunderstood, the weary ladder of knowledge had to be climbed anew. Writing gave a new permanence to the achievements of the mind. It preserved for thousands of years and through a millennium of poverty and superstition, the wisdom found by philosophy and the beauty carved out in drama and poetry. It bound the generations together with a common heritage. It created that country of the mind in which, because of writing, genius need not die. And now, as writing united the generations, print, despite the thousand prostitutions of it, can bind the civilizations. It is not necessary anymore that civilization should disappear before our planet passes away. It will change its habitat. Doubtless the land in every nation will refuse at last to yield its fruit to improvident tillage and careless tenancy. Inevitably, new regions will lure with virgin soil the lustier strains of every race. But a civilization is not a material thing, inseparably bound like an ancient serf to a given spot of the earth. It is an accumulation of technical knowledge and cultural creation. If these can be passed on to the new seat of economic power, the civilization does not die. It merely makes for itself another home. Nothing but beauty and wisdom deserve immortality. To a philosopher, it is not indispensable that his native city should endure forever. He will be content if its achievements are handed down to form some part of the possessions of mankind. We need not fret, then, about the future. We are weary with too much war, and in our lassitude of mind we listen readily to a Spengler announcing the downfall of the Western world. But this learned arrangement of the birth and death of civilizations and even cycles is a trifle too precise. We may be sure that the future will play wild pranks with this mathematical despair. There have been wars before, and man and civilization survived them. Within 15 years after Waterloo, defeated France was producing so many geniuses that every attic in Paris was occupied. Never was our heritage of civilization and culture so secure, and never was it half so rich. We may do our little share to augment it and transmit it, confident that time will wear away chiefly the dross of it, and that what is finally fair and worthy in it will be preserved to illuminate many generations. Chapter 6. 12 Vital Dates in World History. The idea of creating a list of 12 vital dates in history came to me at Manila as I was preparing to set sail across the Pacific to America. It came at an appropriate moment, for it found me struggling with the problem of dates in working on the first volume of The Story of Civilization. It was already quite clear to me that the inclusion of dates in the text would make the story as accurate and dull as a good encyclopedia, that the transformation of dead data into living narrative would require some other disposition of dates than one that would infest with them every page of the tale. The arrangement arrived at, after much pseudopodial trial and error, was to confine all dates to the margin and the notes. Perhaps some such plan would alleviate the pain inflicted by some of the textbooks of history used in our colleges and schools. I had occasion, some years back, to examine the text employed in certain institutions of lower learning in my neighborhood. The geography, which might have been made one of the most fascinating studies of all, was especially abominable, a mere massing of dead information, much of it made false or worthless by the war, much of it restricted to the superficial features of a nation's life, much of it made ridiculous by provincial prejudice against the Orient. But the textbook of history, Bear and Bagley's History of the American People, was intelligently and intelligibly written, recording the progress of civilization as well as the logic-chopping vicissitudes of politics, and presenting its sound scholarship with pleasing artistry. It is a splendid volume. In many high schools I have found, as the standard historical text of world history, Breasted's Ancient Times, which I regard as the finest school book in America, and along with it, only slightly inferior to it, the books of Robinson and Beard on modern European history. In these volumes there is no excessive use of dates, and if we are to agree that dates have been overdone, We shall have to acknowledge also that some of our texts have avoided this fault, and many of them represent a great improvement on the class books of our younger days. I should hardly be content to have my pupils know only 12 dates, and I presume that the choice of this baker's number would not suggest an optimum, but rather a minimum. Dates, let us say, that every baker should know. How many dates a man should carry with him will depend, of course, on his functions and purposes. A farmer might do his job very well and bring up a fine family with no other date in his head than that of the next state fair. But a man condemned to the intellectual life, precluded from the deepening contacts of experiment and action, ought to have sufficient knowledge of man's chronology to give him, as some poor substitute for wide personal experience, that historical perspective which is one road to philosophy and understanding. Such a man should be able to name the century, though not necessarily the precise dates, of world-transforming inventions and discoveries like gunpowder, printing, the steam engine, electricity, and the discovery of America. He should know the centuries of the world's greatest statesmen, say, Hammurabi, Moses, Darius I, Solon, Pericles, Alexander, Caesar, Charles V, Louis XIV, Peter the Great, Frederick the Great, Henry VIII, Elizabeth, Disraeli, Gladstone, Bismarck, Cavour, Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Lincoln. Of the world's greatest scientists and philosophers, say Confucius, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Copernicus, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, Spinoza, Voltaire, Kant, Schopenhauer, and Darwin. Of the world's greatest saints, say Ignaton, Lao Tzu, Isaiah, Buddha, Christ, Marcus Aurelius, Augustine, Francis of Assisi, Loyola, Luther, and Gandhi. This man of intellectual interest should also know the centuries of the world's greatest poets, say Homer, the Psalmist, Euripides, Virgil, Horace, Li Po, Dante, Shakespeare, Milton, Goethe, Pushkin, Keats, Byron, Shelley, Hugo, Poe, Whitman, and Tagore. Of the world's greatest makers of music, say Palestrina, Bach, Handel, Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Liszt, Paganini, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Verdi, Wagner, Paderewski, and Stravinsky. And of the world's greatest artists or works of art, say Karnak and Luxor and the Pyramids, Phidias and Praxiteles, Wu Daozu and Sezshu and Hiroshige, Chartres and Taj Mahal, Giotto and Dürer, Leonardo, Raphael, and Michelangelo, Titian and Correggio, El Greco and Velázquez, Rubens, Rembrandt and Van Dyck, Reynolds and Gainsborough, Turner and Whistler, Millet and Cézanne. I have left out the great prose writers lest this chapter should read like a telephone directory or a list of radical exportees or a register of, quote, dirty foreigners, close quote. The reader can help me by making here his own pantheon. Let him then examine his friends and himself on the centuries and work of these men. Perhaps we should also add a list of great women from Queen Hatshepsut to Madame Curie, and so rate them and himself with a new Binet-Simon test. If, however, one is condemned to live on a mental desert island and can take only 12 dates with him, these dates should presumably be such as to carry in their implications the essential history of mankind. About them should cluster such associations that on their docket the greater achievements of the human mind would string themselves in a concatenation of development, in an order and perspective that would clarify old knowledge and facilitate the new. Since history is varied and all aspects of human activity in any age are bound up with the rest, many such chains of pivotal events might be composed. What follows, then, are not the 12 world dates, they are merely 12. 1. 4241 BC, the introduction of the Egyptian calendar. This date alone, the earliest definite date in history, is sufficient to cause some disturbance to fiercely orthodox souls who believe, as did Bishop Usher, that the world was created in 4004 BC. To accept the testimony of Egyptologists that a calendar existed on the Lower Nile 237 years before the creation of the world might serve as a fertilizing shock to any virgin mind. The implications of that calendar are endless. Consider the development of astronomy and mathematics that must have preceded its formulation. Consider how long even then a civilization must have endured to set aside from the economic life men with leisure enough to chart the stars and capture the course of the sun. It was a very sensible calendar compared with ours. It divided the year into 12 months of 30 days each, with 5 intercalary days at the end for roistering. And it stands in the memory for all Egypt. For 3,000 years of recorded civilization with orderly government, security of life and property, comforts for the body, delights for the senses, and instruction for the mind. It stands for Cheops, who built the greatest of the pyramids, and Thutmose III, who built Karnak, and Ikhnaton, who literally sold his kingdom for a song, arousing revolution by writing a monotheistic hymn. and Cleopatra, who led Anthony to ruin by the nose, if one may speak so metonymically. 2. 543 BC, the death of Buddha. No other soul, I suppose, has ever been so influential. It is not so much that several hundred million men and women profess the Buddhist religion today. In truth, Buddhism does not follow Buddha, but is a mass of legends and superstitions that have no more right to use his name than the ferocious Christianity of Calvin or Torquemada or Tennessee has to use the name of Christ. But Buddha means India, for the spirit of India lies in religion rather than in science, in contemplation rather than in action, in a fraternal gentleness rather than in the application of mathematics to artillery or of chemistry to bombs. Life, said Buddha, is full of suffering. It can be made bearable only by doing no injury to any living thing and speaking no evil of any man, or woman either. Let us hope that that simple religion is what lies behind the infinite superstitions of the Hindu mind today. And let us take the date of Buddha as the beginning of a civilization that has known every vicissitude, every injustice, every slavery, and yet in the midst of it has produced geniuses and saints, from Buddha and Asoka to Gandhi and Tagore. 3. 478 BC, the death of Confucius. We must have some symbol to represent China for us. China, so gigantic in size that it calls itself all under heaven, and so old that it records the doings of its kings for the last 4,000 years. I envy those Chinese schoolboys who are made to memorize every word of Confucius. I have found every line profound and applicable, and sometimes I think that if these maxims had sunk into my memory for 20 years, I might have in me a little of the poise of soul, the simple dignity, the quiet understanding, the depth of character, the infinite courtesy that I have found in the educated Chinese everywhere. Never has one man so written his name upon the face and spirit of a people as Confucius has done in China. Let us take him again as a symbol and a suggestion. Behind him are the delicate lyrics of the Tang Dynasty's poets, the mystic landscapes of the Chinese painters, the perfect vases of the Chinese potters, the secular and terrestrial wisdom of the Chinese philosophers. Perhaps the greatest of all historic civilizations is summed up in his name. 4. 399 BC, the death of Socrates. When this man passed, drunk with hemlock, also passed the most astonishing picture in ancient history, the age of Pericles. But this time I am not thinking of philosophy. Behind Socrates I see his friend and lover, Alcibiades, and the destructive tragedy of the Peloponnesian War. I see Aspasia, the learned courtesan, at whose feet the old gadfly sat with Pericles. I see Pericles gathering rich men around him and persuading them to finance the Athenian drama. I see Euripides contending with Sophocles for the dramatic prize in the theater of Dionysus. I see Actinus, in slow thought, molding the columns of the Parthenon, and Phidias carving the gods and heroes of its frieze. I see young Plato winning the prize at the Pan-Athenian Games. I want some stopping point in history that shall bring to my memory a few of the thousand facets of this brave and varied age, when for the first time a whole civilization liberated itself from superstition and created science, drama, democracy, and liberty, and passed on to Rome and Europe half of our intellectual and aesthetic heritage. 5. 44 BC, the death of Caesar. A few years before the death of George Brandeis, the Danish critic who helped the French Taine to make the British understand English literature, an American student visited him and found him in a very somber mood. "Why are you sad?" the visitor asked. "Don't you know," answered Brandeis, "that this is the anniversary of the greatest blunder in history, the assassination of Caesar?" The old critic might have found blunders nearer home, like the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. And perhaps he exaggerated a little the importance of Brutus's Satis. For in a sense, it is not Caesar whom we wish to remember, it is the succession of developments that followed upon his death. The reconstruction of Roman law and order by the statesman like Augustus on the basis and lines of Caesar's preliminary work. The flourishing of arts and letters under the extension of the Pax Romana to Rome. The poetry of Virgil and Horace. The prose of Pliny and Tacitus. The philosophy of Epictetus and Aurelius, the beneficent rule of Hadrian and Antoninus, the beautification of the Forum and the Capitol with architecture and statuary, the building of those roads and the revision and codification of those laws, which were to be Rome's essential legacy to the modern world. As the death of Socrates may be used to sum up the Periclean Age of Athens, so the death of Caesar stands as the door to the Golden Age of Rome. 6. Unknown BC, the birth of Christ. This date, the reader may place ad lib, since no man knows it. For us, it is the most important date of all because it divides all history in the West, gives us our greatest hero and model, provides us with that body of myth and legend which is now passing from the theological to the literary stage, and marks the beginning of that Christian age which seems today to be approaching its close.